order the House. I'm going to try to call to order the House Committee on Education for Wednesday, February 21st. Members, thank you for adjusting schedules so the full House Committee could meet today. I would like to open a public hearing and work session on Senate Resolution 3A. I would like to make note that Representative Gelser had a wish to be here, and but is feeling ill. Representative Gelser, if you are listening on the internet or watching on TV, we wish you well, and you should know that Representative Clem and I are wearing the appropriate ties for the hearing. For our first presenter on this resolution, Representative Girard is here. So if you come up, and while you're coming up, I'll have Mr. Olson remind us what this resolution is all about.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
As a point of order.
Sir.
Have you opened a public hearing and work session?
Correct.
I believe you can only open a public hearing or a work session.
Thank you very much. Let me ungavel and open a public hearing on Senate Resolution 3. Thank you, Representative Bell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Concurrent Resolution 3A commends the Oregon State University baseball team for winning the National Collegiate Association of Athletics, NCAA Division I national title. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Representative, just to note before you start, I do hope you know that Bill Ralph Ashland was a star player on the Oregon State team, just to let you know.
thank you, Chair Buckley, and fellow legislators. I am Fred Girard, representative from District 17, which covers Northern Centennial Watershed. I also am a proud alum of Oregon State in 1973. I want to thank Chair Buckley for scheduling this meeting and Representative Wisnett for his amendment so that we could get going. I am a fill-in for Representative Sarah Gelser. And I want you to know Sarah Gelser and her staff did a great job of writing me little idiot notes. So it says, Representative Sarah Gelser is sick. She sends regrets that she isn't there, and she loves Beaver baseball. And this is kind of the way that it looks. So this is a Democrat to a Republican. This is
very good. If you'd like that in the record, you could amend it.
Actually, I'm here to testify in favor of SCR 3. Many of us in the building enjoy college sports. There's banners for both Oregon State, Portland State, and many other colleges in the building, but rarely does the state have a national champion. This bill pays tribute to the 2006 Oregon State Beaver baseball team who made the state proud. Not only did they win the World Series, but they faced five elimination games. Further, most of the team was homegrown. I counted like 25 different people Ashland was representing. And this really is a monumental thing for the state, and I urge that you support SCR 3. And also, I have been informed that Representative Holvey might have a gut and stuff for the Oregon team, and I would oppose such a gut and stuff.
So noted. Discussion.
I'm sorry, and that wasn't a duck call.
Also, you're up on that. Representative Wisnett is also, I think, well prepared for. Would you care to make the first comment here, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the representative bringing this bill forward. There was an inconsistency. I'm sure the media had it wrong, or however, but it was a great World Series, and I do salute the Beavers from OSU. My wife went there. Her father went there. However, as a politician, I was pulling for my Tar Heels, but not disappointed in the outcome. So,
very good.
The Beavers, but they did not sweep them. It was a close game with the Tar Heels ahead, winning the first game, ahead in the second game. Coach left the pitcher in too long. The last game they were ahead, and the coach put a catcher on first base who'd never played first base. That missed a throw that allowed the Beavers to come back and win this championship. And again, I salute the Beavers.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Clem, did you have some comments you wanted to offer?
Figure out if I'm testifying over there or not.
Oh, yes, you will be testifying next.
Oh, then.
Yes, you can. Representative Dolan.
I have absolutely no doubt and have had no doubt for many years as to what a Beaver was. But do you know what a Tar Heel is?
Actually, I would refer that to.
Yeah, is this germane to the bill? Any other questions for or observations that you'd like this witness to comment on?
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative. Representative Roblin did have a question. I'm sorry.
One. You know, I haven't had a chance to meet all these players, having been a Duck, and I was a Beaver for a short period of time. But I did have the opportunity to hire a young man who played football for the Beavers until he got hurt. Outstanding young man. And I guess what I'd ask you is, if they're all the same caliber as Andy Darkins was, who worked for me, these are an outstanding young men. And I guess I'd ask you about the character of these young people, not just this part, but...
Well, I would like to answer that. And I think the character actually showed through in this baseball team, because especially in Game 1 of the World Series, they were behind by, I think, 5 runs. And they came back. And they came back in numerous circumstances, and they faced 5 elimination games. And that shows me character of people that don't want to quit. And I think that's an important part of this team. Not only did they win the national championship, but they really did it with class.
Thank you.
I can't resist now. Okay.
You may not get out of here.
Well, hey, if we're going to be lauding graduates of OSU, I have several male cousins, and one of them played for the NFL for 8 years, and they all went through Oregon State. They all played football, and there are all four of them are incredible men. Oh. And, you know, go Beavs. What can we say?
Hey, go Beavs, yeah. You
thank
that.
You, Representative.
And remember, the gun stuff's an automatic no vote.
All right. Representative Clem, would you like to offer some testimony on this resolution?
That's my first cousin.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Very Baker played in the 60s.
Yeah.
Giving you a hug.
No, well, he played in the 60s. But they all played 8-man football, and they all ended up playing for Oregon State.
Oh, that's
coming up
for us.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brian Clem, a former student body president at Oregon State University, 1993-94. Also played rover position in the Intramural Softball League, A-League. finished second 2 years in a row, but pretty solid rover. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, is rover that position that they put you in because they can't figure out where in the hell you might be?
The one that goes and collects the balls after they go.
That could very well.
Ah, that's the one.
I just wanted to speak in favor of the resolution, urge you to support it, even with the amendments noting North Carolina Tar Heels. The other fact I just want to get across that's in the resolution, I want to get on the record, is that our coach, Pat Casey, was named the National Coach of the Year as well. So the team had great honors, and then he was named Coach of the Year. Just quickly on any potential gut and stuff, if we want to do a separate bill that rewards the like T-ball team or intramural team or whatever that is down at U of O, you know, I'd be willing to work with a kind of a bipartisan teamwork bill with someone to honor their little fun T-ball team. But this is serious baseball, and I think we need to leave it just like it is.
Thank you, Representative, for those comments. Seeing now, there are questions. Representative Roblin.
All I can say, having been a principal for a number of years and having one of the students from that school sitting in front of me today, is to say that it's really appreciative that for the first time I see a tie. And if this can't, if bringing a tie to the place happens because of this bill, and it would continue, it'd be really a great thing. So I really appreciate the fact that this bill has served its purpose today.
Make you want to vote for it?
Representative Greenlick, did you have something?
Could we ask the witness to sing the fight song?
We could, but it would be the wrong thing to do.
Okay.
I'd like to say to Representative Clem, I had the opportunity to carry the bill when we recognized Linfield for their national championship. And I think we should take just a moment and say to the Beavers, as we did to the Linfield team, well done, hale and hearty, and we're proud of you.
That's true.
Very good words. Thank you, Representative. That is, I think, a good... summation of where we are at all. Thank you, Rick.
Also Sun Bowl champions. Sun Bowl. 2006 Sun Bowl champion,
right.
Oregon
that's
State football.
Yep.
That's one of
I thought we weren't going to amend this bill.
I'm sorry.
We hear an amendment?
Thank you, Representative. With gratitude, I'm going to close this public hearing. Unless there's anyone else who wanted to testify on this bill, this resolution?
I can't believe we don't have a whole list of people that want to testify.
Well, I think, I think they're all just kind of knowing that this is going to move forward. I think they have confidence on this. And I think Representative Dahlem summarized it very well. So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution 3 and open up a work session on Senate Concurrent Resolution number 3. And I would entertain a motion.
I would make a motion that we accept or pass Senate Concurrent Resolution number 3 and move it to the floor.
We do pass?
And that it to be adopted.
Representative Dahlem has moved that Senate Concurrent Resolution 3 be moved to the floor to be adopted. Any further discussion?
Yes, can I? Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlee.
I mean, we've been making a joke here, but the truth of the matter is I was really intrigued with how the work of this team in the World Series sort of electrified the state. Mm-hmm. These games are on television. Everybody, everywhere you went, people were talking about this team, and it really did, I think, have an important pride factor for the state of Oregon, and I think this is a well-deserved memorial.
And
was there real
along that note as well, it wasn't just, I mean, it was almost all of the Northwest states. I mean, you know, this is something that hasn't happened from states in the northern part of our country. They don't win this championship. It is a very rare thing, and for a whole lot of reasons. And you watch these students, and I really appreciated the comments on the character of the team, because I really, it came through over and over again. And you watch people, whoever they were and whoever their allegiance were, come behind this team, and it was a great thing of pride for Oregon, and I concur.
Absolutely. Any additional comments? Thank you very much. We'll then like to have a roll call vote, please.
Aye.
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 Representative
Trump?
Aye.
Representative
Cromwell?
Aye.
Representative
Lim?
Aye.
Representative
Lisnett?
Aye.
Aye. The motion carries. Representative Clem, I'm wondering if you might be interested in carrying this resolution to the floor on behalf of our
wear
committee.
Wear a tie again.
So good? Thumbs up. All right.
He should be prepared to sing the
song. He should be prepared. Would you please maybe sing the song as part of the presentation on the floor?
And Chair Buckley, what about an open invitation to Representative Gilzer, since she sponsored the bill, to assist in that? Mm-hmm.
That's a very good comment. Is that...
You guys can sing the fight song together.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. Can we put down Clem and Gilzer would be great. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, committee. I'm going to open a first public hearing on House Bill 2641. And I'm going to ask Mr. Olson to announce the bill. I'm going to ask Representative Kopp if she would be so kind to take the gavel. I am going to actually testify on behalf of this bill.
My honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, you have before you the staff measure summary for House Bill 2641. The measure changes the amount of school district local option taxes that are not considered local revenue for the purposes of state school fund distribution formula, changes the amount that school district may receive as a local option equalization grant, takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment. Also attached, I believe, is the draft revenue impact statement. We did not have a fiscal impact statement yet from the fiscal office prior to the meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Buckley, whenever you're ready.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Kopp. For the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley from House District 5 in South Jackson County. I bring to you House Bill 2641 after discussions with my local school districts. Oregon law allows for school districts to collect certain amounts of local option taxes that will not be considered as local revenue in determining the distribution of funds from the state school fund. School districts are currently limited in the amount they can collect, with over-collections being subtracted from the district's state school fund allocation. One of the limitations is the requirement that the amount collected be equal to $750 per average daily membership weighted. An increasing number of Oregon school districts, including the districts I represent, are considering local option levies to help fund vital programs for their students. The $750 per average daily membership requirement is keeping school districts, such as Ashland's, from asking voters to approve levies that go higher than this amount, but still fall within all other legal requirements. The bill before you today would remove this cap, allowing willing communities to fund their districts to a higher degree. And again, just a little bit of background on my district. The voters of my district have voted to place a levy on ourselves. We have done it repeatedly to fund programs that we feel are essential. It's my view this is very much a local control issue that should be decided under the Measure 5 restrictions. Measure 5 should be the place where we draw the line and allow local communities to make their decision how much they would like to tax themselves under the local option. I have a map, too, that of all the districts that have tried and to pass levies in the state. I'm sorry I don't have copies for all of it because it would be too expensive and limited budget. District levy elections have taken place throughout the state of Oregon, many successful, many unsuccessful because of double majority or other reasons, but it is something that school districts statewide are attempting to do to address programs. In Ashland, we use the funds brought in from the levy for what we see to be absolutely essential services for the children of our district. So I'd be happy to answer any questions. I also have asked for the superintendent of the Ashland School Districts to be available by phone. She has, of course, studied this backwards and forwards, and be happy to talk about this as well.
Do we have questions for Representative Buckley before we call the superintendent? Representative Greenleaf.
Thank you. Just for clarification, you're saying this would be inside the 1.5% property tax limitation?
That's correct, Chair Comp, Representative Greenock. That's absolutely correct. This Measure 5 does set the cap. You can't go above that. Right now, in law, there is that $750 per student cap that exists. It's been there since Measure 5, and as you know, costs have increased so tremendously for the programs.
May I ask another question, please? Yes. How would the Multnomah County I-tax that was gathered in school superintendent, this would be the same thing? That could be used above the $750?
Chair Comp, Representative Greenock, it's my understanding that the I-tax is a separate vehicle for revenue, that this is the local property tax levy that a district can vote upon itself under Measure 5, and income tax is outside of the Measure 5 provision.
And outside the $750 limitation?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Roebling?
Yeah, and this might be better for you, Superintendent, but I'll ask and see if you have an answer. One of the problems and one of the reasons that we ended up with a state school funding had to do with the disparity between school districts and the equality of that. And so there were a number of school districts that fought that, and part of that was because certain districts had greater ability to pass local options. And so as we start to exceed this limit, and if there gets to be more and more money, that inequity could be brought back into the system by local property taxes and all of a sudden spur that group to go back to court to say we have an unequal system again. Are you concerned, or do you see that as a problem with this bill?
Chair Comp, Representative Roebling, I think it's an excellent question, and I do firmly believe that there should be every attempt made by the state to provide not only an adequate education, but an excellent education for every child in the state. I do think that there's also a valid argument to be made that within the boundaries of the state, providing a basic education for every child, that there should be the ability for local communities to decide upon on themselves to tax themselves at the level that they are comfortable to do so. And as I noted on the map, which you probably wouldn't be able to see, these elections have happened throughout the state where different communities have raised that question for themselves to say, where do we think it's essential to add programs for our children to do. This still stays within even the levies that we have passed on ourselves, and even the cap, if you take out the 750, go all the way up to the Measure 5 limits, we're still not talking about a night and day scenario. We're talking about districts that vote upon themselves to pay some extra money to get some extra programs. It's open to every community in the state. In Ashland's case in particular, we have a situation where the gap between our wealthiest citizens and our impoverished citizens is growing tremendously. I think it's a very positive thing that the citizens of Ashland are willing, particularly those who are property owners, are willing to consistently vote additional taxes on themselves that would provide services for people of all economic levels.
Representative Dahl?
Representative Buckley, this equity issue, when you mention local control, you tug at my heartstrings. When you
Representative.
You give the voters an option to say yes or no about their school, it does a lot more than just give them money. It gives them a place at the table. It gives them a part in the game. But we did struggle in the middle 80s with equity. And that equity issue was resolved in most of our neighboring states with vicious and violent lawsuits. We dodged the bullet here because of Measure 5. I don't know whether I think I might be saying something nice about Measure 5. And that just took away all that warm and fuzzy feeling. Have you had this? And I don't want the legislature to run to the judicial system to ask them for permission to pass law. But has anybody looked at this in light of that equity? Because if we get out of balance, I served in a school that was in compression and lost about 25% of their spending authority because we were so rich, and that was painful. And I would like to know if you've talked to anyone or if someone with a legal look at equity has had a chance to review this with you.
Representative Comp, Representative Dunn, thank you for the question. I have not. I did check with OSBA on the history of the cap and whether the OSBA had any problems with an effort to raise the cap. They had none, and they didn't flag any legal problems given that Measure 5 was clear with its intent, and this falls within Measure 5. It does not exceed Measure 5. So I have not had, and I will see if we can get a legal opinion on it, but I have not had a discussion on the legal side of it.
Thank you. Follow up.
Yes.
Now, because of the local tax situation, the gap between what some districts were able to levy and what the state was providing was significant. In other districts where they were tax poor or assessment poor, the gap was much smaller. How would we address that so that all districts would have an equal shot?
Chair Comp, Representative Dahlman, in my view, by lifting the cap, that provides the greatest flexibility for whatever the parameters that a given city or district finds itself in, that would give them the greatest leeway to adjust their particular levy proposal to fit their need. The cap, there's no floor right now, but the cap is at 750. So, and again, if I can bring Ashland as an example, we've closed two schools in the last several years. We have a decline in enrollment because of the loss of state funds due to the closures of the schools and decline in enrollment. This levy is one of the tools that we have in order to maintain a high quality education experience.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for the Chair first.
Yes, sir.
Will OEA, the superintendent, or the governor's office testifying on this bill?
We have no other testimony other than information that will be shared by the superintendent in Ashland. Nobody signed up today.
And I have a couple of questions. Representative, could you explain to me the 15%? How do you come up with the $750? I mean, what... So we pass a, is it 10% of the 4,500 per student, or how do we hit the cap? I don't understand that.
Representative, page 3, line 26, is where we are removing the delegate per district extended ADMW.
That's in the statute now.
That's current in the statute now, so we would be removing that.
Yeah, but...
Go ahead, please.
But I don't understand, how do we get more money? What's it based upon? What's the 15% of what gives me $750, or 15% of what gives me $1,000? How do I get there?
Chair Comp, Reverend Wisdom, I'm going to punt that to my superintendent.
Okay.
Can we go ahead?
Yeah.
What do you want to get?
Also, I could, Madam Chair, I might be able to offer a clarifying comment. Chair Comp, members of the committee, if you look at your staff measure summary, the cap is of the general purpose grant, transportation grant, facility grant, and high cost disabilities grant. And so, in other words, when it says 15%, that's 15% of that money. And currently, the cap is a dollar and a percentage
and this bill would remove the dollar and just leave the percentage. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So roughly is that those numbers, it's $4,500 per student, so then you're going to add the transportation grant and all that could come to, what, $10,000?
Cool. Madam Chair, if I can, I believe my superintendent will be able to illuminate this. We will, after discussing this with school board members, we will also be looking to work this bill to see how that percentage works in and to see if the percentage needs to be adjusted as well.
Okay. Just a minute. We have several people that have questions. I'm wondering, since this is your bill, Representative Buckley, should we get your superintendent on the line?
I would recommend it because she is much smarter than I am.
That we can, so she hears the kind of the conversation, and we're just not hitting her cold with tough questions.
I have a question that just pertains to the representative, and it's.
Well, you're third on the list, sir.
I thought you were going to preclude all of us. But while you're dialing, I could ask him a question while you're dialing. I'm going to request information that I'm sure.
Yes, sir.
When we see this for the work session, could we see what the impact is on each school district? And I think that can be run by ODE.
Yeah, you said you weren't going to ask a tough question.
I don't think that's a...
Chair Kopp, Representative Dahl, I will ask ODE and I'll also ask OSBA if they have those figures.
Well, Steve Meyer down at LFO is also available to assist in that type of a scenario.
Thank you very much for the privilege, Madam Chair.
I'm teasing. Do you want Derek, do you want to get a hold of our superintendent?
Madam Chair, yes, I will call the superintendent and just also draw attention to the impact statement, which may have some clarifying, the revenue impact statement may help clarify some questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. We couldn't live without you.
The job progress grant, the transportation grant, the facility grant, and the high cost disability grant.
And will you clarify with her the question that Representative Wisnett asking?
Hi, this is Derek Olson from the House Education Committee in Salem. May I please have the superintendent of Extension 101?
$6,000 times 6 is $600.
Hello?
Hi, this is Derek Olson from the House Education Committee. Can you hear me?
Derek, how you doing?
Good. You're on speakerphone in front of the committee, which is now in session, having a public hearing on House Bill 2641. And you're being asked to testify, and there's some questions for you. Can you I'll turn the questions over to Chair Buckley. Thank you.
Superintendent DiCiro, thank you very much for joining us today. So far, I was able to introduce the bill, and the committee has several questions. I believe we'll start off with Representative Clem. Did you have a question?
Well, I want to answer Jean's first.
I'm sorry. I remember you had questions that I was not able to answer. Would you like to ask them for the superintendent?
I'm sorry. Superintendent, thank you for making yourself available. And I think maybe I found the answer that... what we're multiplying by to get the $750 or what would be. I'm looking at your general purpose grant, your transportation grant, your facility grant, and the high cost disabilities grant of your district. Does that equal about $6,000 per student?
That would not be the multiplier, I don't believe. The $750 would be multiplied by the ABMW. So you take the average daily membership and then the weighted formula. So if you're looking at the state school fund printout, you'd have to look at the box in the upper left-hand corner where it talks about the ADMW. So it would take that number times the $750.
But that's if the cap is in place.
Oh. Hold on. I'm sorry. Superintendent, would you please identify yourself for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, this is Julie DiCiro, and I'm the superintendent of Ashland Schools.
Thank you very much. And she just mentioned a paper that we don't have in front of us.
Right.
So, yeah,
okay.
We'll have to
so but basically the reports that come out to school districts is called the State School Fund Report, and it actually gives us two pieces of information on there. One is information related to enrollment, and that's expressed in the average daily membership or called ABM. And then there's a weighted formula that goes through. So, for instance, for special education students, they are weighted an additional student, ELL students, kids in poverty, So it comes out to, you get a weighted formula, and that is what the number that multiplies times the $750.
That's not the question. Superintendent, what I'm trying to determine is how much money would this generate? And that would be based, I think, upon the general purpose grant, the transportation grant, the facility grant, and the high cost disabilities grant of the district is what we're told here. In other words, the 15% is going to be 15% of that total.
Well, no, there's two different limits here. So let's just back up a little bit because local option, currently the way that local option is written for school districts is that it allows school districts to go out to their local communities and ask them to fund, and the first limitation on that is the gap between Measure 5 and Measure 47 and 50. And so let me just spend a minute talking about that because it's a little complex, and one of the issues around this local option is the complexity of it to communicate to our constituents. But basically what happens is when Measure 5 was passed, school districts were allowed to assess $5 per thousand on property based on the real market value of that property. Then, later on, when 47 and 50 were passed a few years later, that actually changed that formula from the real market value of those properties to the assessed value. And Measure 50 actually locked in the assessed value at a particular rate in 1995. And then all property has been allowed to grow at 3% per year since that time. And so what we have in Ashland and other places as well is a big difference between what the real market value is and the assessed value is. And that is referred to as the gap between assessed value and real market value. What the local option that the legislature passed in 1999 allows local districts to do is to tax that gap. So the first thing we have to look at for a school district is there a gap on real property between the assessed value and the real market value? So in most cases, that answer is yes, there is a gap between that, because Ashland, of course, is a poster child for the fact that our property values have grown so quickly. So that's the first measurement, and that is, so if there is no gap, you can't tax it. So one of the problematic issues behind the local option levy is that different pieces of property in our taxation zone are taxed, will be taxed differently, because it really depends on how much gap there is. So for instance, commercial property, there isn't much of a gap between the assessed and the real value because of other issues the way the commercial property is taxed. But residential property does have the gap, but then depending on when someone bought their house, if they bought, for instance, a newly constructed house in the last couple of years, there's not much gap between the assessed value and the real market value. As opposed to a piece of property that may have been in existence for a while, there's quite a bit of the gap. So that's the first measurement that we look at. So that, a local community could say, okay, we want to tax at a particular rate, and as long as that rate is within the gap, they are allowed to do that. The legislature then passed two other limits to that beyond the gap funding, and that is that it can't exceed $750 per student, so that's when you take that ADMW number times the $750, or 15% of your general fund operating revenue. The things that you are referring to are all things that make up our general fund. So There's several different components to this that need to be discussed.
Okay.
Is that clear as mud?
No, I think you did an excellent job. I want to keep going with Representative Wisdom here until he's clear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for your... Superintendent, thank you very much. I guess the basic question is, if we pass this bill and you have no cap, how much money are you looking at that you would go... You know, what's the maximum you would go out with at 15%?
If you eliminate the $750 limitation and the 15%, then what it would come down to is the maximum you could levy would be what exists in your gap. That would be a limitation. But I think more importantly, it would be what your local community was willing to support. And so you'd have to go to your local community and convince them that whatever rate you're going to levy is going to be a good investment of their tax dollars in their local schools. And so it actually goes back to a local control issue of allowing local communities to take a look at their school districts and say, what's going to make the difference here for our kids and what are we willing to do in terms of that, so that it comes back to the voters deciding what the limits are going to be as opposed to that being imposed by the legislature.
Superintendent, if I may, I believe Reverend Wiss is trying to get to, if you have any dollar figures, compared to what Ashland's levies have been up to this point.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry I didn't understand that. Right now, our youth activities levy, and I don't know if Representative Buckley has been able to bring you up to date on why we can't continue with that, but at any rate, we know that our youth activities levy is when it sunsets in June of 2008 due to a recent Supreme Court decision, we're not going to be able to go out with that same taxing mechanism anymore, so we're going to have to convert it to a local option. Currently, our youth activities levy is collecting about $2.3 million a year.
Let me try this.
That is a city local option. It is not a school district local option. It's actually collected by the city. And then some of the funds go through our parks department and then come to the school district to fund extracurricular sports and activities and programs in our district which are not required by the state and not they're in a non-graded environment and they're not required. So they're all the things that if they went away tomorrow, we could still run the school district. It may not be the one we have today, but it doesn't fund any core program. And the vast majority of it goes to extracurricular sports and activities.
Want to try again, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Superintendent, let me try this. You know, your points are well made, and we appreciate it, and we have a lot of empathy for you. The issue we're trying to look here is we're trying to pass a state law.
Right.
And we're also concerned about equity within the state. Is, you know, what you're proposing, I think members of this committee may have trouble if that would amount to $2,000 more a student.
I don't think it's $2,000 more a student, and right now you do have a number of districts in the state who are already accessing the local option levy. And so it's not just Ashland. And the other point I think is really important to consider here is that about 65% of the districts in Oregon are in declining enrollment. And Ashland, of course, is one of those. And so as our enrollment declines, of course, all of our resources decline as well because all of our current resources are based on per pupil's expenditures. And so in a declining enrollment situation, I'm going to use Ashland for an example. We're losing about 100 students a year because we're graduating classes of about 270 kids from Ashland High School, and then we're bringing in anywhere from 150 to 160 kids in kindergarten. And that's due to our many factors that are going on demographically in our community. So when we lose those 100 students a year, roughly that's equal to about $500,000 less revenue that we're getting from the state. If we adjust for those 100 lost students, and we're fortunate enough to be able to adjust for teachers, that saves us about $240,000, which means the remaining $260,000 has to come out of other program or other staffing. And so schools in a declining enrollment are not able to make up for the loss in state revenue simply by adjusting for enrollment. There's other cuts that have to come about as well. The advantage of removing the limits on the local option levy would be that then for those 65% of those districts, again, in our state, they're declining enrollment, there would at least be one revenue source that wasn't tied to enrollment and would help stabilize what's going on in those school districts. Here in Rogue Valley, we can look at the Rogue River School District, who basically are very, very close to not being able to operate anymore, even though they're offering quality programs to their kids. They have the second highest test scores in our valley, but they just simply are to the point where their declining enrollment has taken all options away from them. So by offering districts like Rogue River, like Ashland, like other districts in our state that are declining in enrollment, another option that local communities can consider that would allow them to have a resource that is not tied to enrollment would also be of great value, not just to Ashland, but across the state.
Thank you, Superintendent. We have quite a list of members who want to ask questions here, and I think Representative Clem, you were next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to make sure I understand some of this correctly. Would this, or does the local option situation only apply to in areas where there is no compression or when there is still a gap?
That's correct. That's it only allows for the gap funding. There's no other option. If there is no gap, then districts don't have that as an option.
Okay. So there's, follow-up, there's not a competition between county sheriff budget and schools because there's no they've already filled up the room for what they can get on any given issue, and there's still a gap, then say, well, can schools go in and fill the gap? Got it. Okay, the only other question I had, this is for you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned...
My understanding is the gap is between measure 50 and true value.
Right.
Not between everybody asking for things within the measure 50.
That's correct. The compression issue should not be an issue because it doesn't affect other people's ability to levy their tax rate. It truly is that gap that exists between what was brought into the Constitution via measure 5 and what was brought in 47. So that is what has established the gap. And the legislature passed the local option levy in 1999 based on that gap, and it does not affect the ability of other authorities within that range, the county, the cities, to assess up to their limits as well.
You've created another question for me, though. I'll follow up on that. No other entity.
I'm not a taxation expert, by the way.
You're doing great, Superintendent. Yeah. Thank you, Representative.
This is based on my own experience in learning about this.
None of those other entities, though, that are in compression can go after that gap between the values, can they? It's just something created for schools,
that's
essentially?
Correct. That's correct.
Well, that's interesting. One more.
Representative Glenn, I heard about that.
Yeah. You, I'm the freshman. I know I'm
this
learning a lot of this.
It's serious.
You had mentioned, so the equalization formula sort of only applies to income taxes right now, really?
Property,
or is it everything?
It's everything. Tax as well.
And except these local options don't spit into the equalization formula, I assume, and then go back out. It's just for that one little, whoever passes it.
Correct.
That's correct.
And that's where the constitutional questions come up. You know, how much of that can you not do through the equalization formula before you come out of compliance?
Correct.
Okay, I understand. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Kreml, you're next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I may, for just a moment before I ask my questions, save for Representative Lim, I'm the only one on the panel that was here when this was originally passed. And I'm sure Representative Lim will correct me if I'm wrong. But one of the reasons why the 10% and $500 was chosen was because that was about the extent of what the gap was, number one. And number two is that it set a limit so that the taxpayer advocates in the state didn't get overly anxious about just sort of giving carte blanche to whatever that gap was, to just being able to go out and tax it. And the third thing, it was given so only to schools because that's where there was felt that there was a need for some of the local control to be exercised. And then in 2003, when we adjusted it up, again, it was in response to what was available in that gap. So I just want to give you that as a little bit of historical context to this whole notion of the local option taxes. But my question is, Superintendent, you may not know the answer to this, but we normally, when there's a revenue impact, we normally get a run from, it's called a run from the Legislative Revenue Office that tells us what the impact of it is on past performance as well as what it would be in the future. In other words, so you can see, well, Ashland Schools, for example, with this bill, this is how much they would get in 2007. This is how much they got in 2005, 2006. So you could see what the comparison was. So while I recognize that our Legislative Revenue Office has shown that there is zero impact on the state school fund, I would argue that there is
going to be some kind of an impact on the state school fund, and I would ask what that is. And maybe there isn't. Maybe I'm wrong on that. But I'm just wondering, is that something that is coming in the future? Is Mr. Myers going to be providing us with that?
Depends on whether a local option is passed. No local option passed, there's no impact.
Well, again, and again, I'm not a taxation expert, but my understanding of it is there is no impact on the state school fund because this is a local tax that's collected locally and is over and above the $5 per thousand that school districts K-12 already has access to. So that it doesn't even get into the formula, it's not considered in the formula, and the only time it would be considered is if, for instance, if a local option was passed. And because of, again, some of the vagaries of this particular taxation measure, which make it difficult to say, okay, we're levying this rate and it's going to result in this amount of taxation coming in, of revenue coming in, because, again, there's a difference between tax lots. But say, for instance, a local district passed a local option levy and they collected more than either that $750 limit or the 15%. In that case, that additional revenue that they collected would then count as local revenue and would then decrease the amount that they got from the state school formula.
Okay, thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Crowell.
Superintendent, I'm hoping that you can help me understand something because I have struggled with this for a long time, but I've never claimed to be a math wizard, so maybe that answers it. But when you have declining enrollment, shouldn't your costs go down also, and therefore the need for more funding shouldn't be there? I mean, help me understand the dynamics here of why it is that lower enrollment doesn't equal lower budget.
Well, it does somewhat. And so, you know, for instance, I'm going to go back to my example. If we lose 100 students, it translates to roughly a little over $500,000 for us. So approximately we budget teachers on about a 25-to-1 basis, so that for every 25 students we have a teacher. And so if we look at eliminating 4 teachers because I've lost 100 students, you know, sometimes I don't lose those students in quite such a way that I can eliminate 4 teachers, but let's just say I'm able to do that. The cost of those 4 teachers saves me about, depending on the 4 that we lose, so if I'm losing people that are senior, that's one thing. If I'm losing people that are in the beginning of their career, that's another. But let's just say as an average, that's about $60,000 per teacher. So as we look at that, that might save me $240,000. I still have to make up that $260,000 someplace else, and it's not just in staffing. And so what I need to do is for every 100 students that we lose, I actually cut about 6 teachers, and that ends up increasing class size. So there's only a certain point to which you can do that and still run an effective school. So then you have to look at the other portions of your budget for the rest of that. So I guess it's not a proportional decline, and that's why school districts that are either rapidly growing in enrollment or even slightly growing in enrollment actually have the advantage, because the converse of what I just told you is true. If they gain 100 students, they gain about $500,000. By adding on those additional 4 teachers, they're only spending, again, if you use that average of $60,000 just for a placeholder, they're spending anywhere from $240,000 to $250,000. They still have that additional $250,000 to add into program. And so it's the formula that is good for increasing enrollment districts is very devastating for decreasing enrollment districts. Right. So I don't know if I'm being clear, but it isn't a direct proportion. I could just reduce staffing based on the number of kids I'm losing, and it all comes out as a wash. It's actually there's more cuts that have to be made to make up for that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
The one part of that side of that, Superintendent, that you didn't address, though, is the phantom students, because we know that under state law, you can choose whether to get, whether to take your census from the current year or the previous year. If you take it for the previous year when your enrollment was 100 students higher,
that's correct.
Then, in fact, you don't lose that
$500,000. Well, but the thing is, I'm leaving every year, and so it is delaying it for a year. And so I do see that. That is a real advantage in the formula for declining enrollment. There's no question, and I don't want to understate that. That is a big advantage and does help us a lot. But when you are in a consistently declining situation, it's not just a one-year situation. It is happening year after year, and many districts are in that same situation. Nashville's not alone in this. Then, the next year is really, yes, you're able to delay it for a year, but the next year looks just as bad, the next year after that looks just as bad. And for us, we really won't stabilize. For right now, my small cohort groups of kids are in the fourth grade, and then once my fifth graders this year go on to middle school, I'll be able to stabilize at the elementary level. We've already closed 2 out of 5 elementary schools here in Ashland to account for that loss of enrollment. We've done a lot of very hard work here trying to cut our budget to respond to our declining enrollment situation. School closures are probably one of the toughest things that communities have to go through, and we've closed 2. Now that those smaller cohort groups are going to meet, go into the middle school, and so it's actually going to take me now, those kids will be in sixth grade, another 6 years before I'm stabilized at all levels of the organization. And so now the cuts are going to be happening in middle school, and after that they're going to hit high school until we adjust for all of those things. So potentially 6 years from now, we will stabilize at a rate where we are able to not be in such a rapidly declining enrollment situation. But otherwise, those so-called phantom students, although very helpful over time, it kind of comes out in the wash. So if it was a one-year decline and the next year we were right back up, then, yeah, that would really help me. But since it's a decline year after year, it isn't as helpful.
Thank you. Rep. Sam Crummell.
I understand what you mean. The Portland area is going through the same exact thing, or the Portland schools in particular are going through the exact same thing. However, you have fixed costs and you have variable costs, and it seems to me that your variable costs would be able to be adjusted downward to make up for that. But that's not the case.
Well, right now about 85% of my budget is salary and benefits, and 15% are the more fixed cost elements of it that really we've cut in that 15%. But now we have to pay our utility bills, we've got to pay for some supplies, we've got to keep our schools maintained, and so that there's nothing left to be saved there. And so it all comes down to staffing after that. And so we've cut our custodial, all of our classified positions to the point where we are just where we can stay operational. And so all is left is teachers. So what we know is what we're doing as we cut is that we're causing class sizes to go up. And this is even with the wonderful governor's budget of $6.0 billion, which I'm so happy to see, and I'm not complaining about that whatsoever. But just know that in a declining enrollment situation, it's not sufficient for us to be able to not start cutting program and teachers and the things that make a difference for kids. So it is, again, going back to this local option, it gives local communities the opportunity to take a look at what's going on in their school district and make that decision on whether or not they want to support their local school district attempt to continue to provide a quality education. And so it does allow a mechanism there for those local communities to take a look at how much are we willing to tax ourselves. And so to me, the limit should be, what do local communities decide? Let that local decision-making take place as opposed to the legislature putting those limits on local communities.
Thank you. Representative Dahlem.
Yes, I want to go back to this gap issue. Representative Dahlem, by the way, House District 59, the Dalles, John Day, that area. When we put in ballot measure 5 and we were assessing on real value, Then 50 went to the assessed value. All new construction came on the market with a trended
3%. That's right.
That created a different assessed value for two houses of equal real value. Is that correct?
You know, again, I'm not a taxation.
Let me tell you where I'm.
So I don't want to answer that question because I'm not 100% sure of the answer. But what I will say is that new construction is in a different ballgame than existing construction that was here prior to 1995. And so the new construction would have less of a gap between what's happening with their assessed value and their real market value, unless you're in an area, again, like Ashland, where that's just growing so quickly that the gap exists after a couple of years.
I think we're going to get to the same point. So that high growth districts, because of the trending on the 3%, do not have the capability or the wideness in the gap that they would have if we had the same assessment system. I think that's correct, isn't it?
You know, that could be, and again, I'm going to have to yield on that one. I'm not expert enough to answer that.
I think we should get somebody, Mr. Chair, that can explain that to us, because new growth districts, and I see several on the dais here that live in those areas. But then I want to go, if I may, Mr. Chairman, one other question on the gap. The gap is different in every school district in the state. Am I making a true statement when I say that?
I think that's probably true.
So that the impact of this bill would be different on every school district in the state.
That's probably true.
Thank you very much.
More students. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you very much. Just for information, I represent in my district the Portland Public Schools, the Beaverton Schools, and the Hillsborough Schools, so I see districts that are very different in their needs. Let me frame this first question I have. I have two questions. I happen to have access a couple years back to property tax bills from three counties, Multnomah County, Crook County, and Tillamook County. And I noticed that in Multnomah County, the tax load was pretty close to the 1.5% limitation. In the Crook County and Tillamook County basis, the tax rate was closer to 1%, maybe a little less than that. And I understand the difference in the potential evaluation of properties in different districts, but I also noted by this a different propensity to tax themselves even against equal values. Do you know if in your county the tax rate is closer to 1.5%? Or is less than that?
You know, again, guys, I really apologize, but I'm not a taxation expert. You know, I'm the superintendent of schools, and so I don't know the answers to those questions. And perhaps Representative Buckley, you can get better information from county assessors or whatever to address these questions, because I don't want to speak to something that I don't have any expertise on.
Superintendent, I appreciate that, and you're doing absolutely fantastic in explaining your situation, and we don't anticipate that you'd be a tax expert. Just appreciate your time.
Let me put this question on the record, which the superintendent might not be able to ask, although I thought I saw Mr. Sager out there, and he'd probably get he's gone again. In addition to that question I just asked, which caused some differences in the communities, one of the issues that makes the people in my district want to at least have the option for taxing themselves in a special way for things that go only to their schools is the idea that some counties are what might be called net debtors, and some counties are what might be called net contributors. My impression of my district is that, from the data I've seen, the citizens in my district pay taxes, and 80% of them come back to the schools for every dollar. 80 cents out of every dollar comes back to the schools, and 20 cents of every dollar goes somewhere else. And that makes the citizens in my district willing to say, okay, I'll happily send that 20 cents somewhere else, but don't you want to give me the option, if I want to spend another dime to support my own schools, to do that? How far down that equalization scale do I have to? How much money do I have to send to Paisley, for example, and to school districts throughout the state that end up with more revenue per student than my
own students can get. And I was wondering whether you might know this, whether your county, Representative Buckley, is a net debtor or a net creditor in terms of...
Representative Greenlee, I remember there was an article in the Oregonian about this about a year ago, and if I recall correctly, Jackson County is also exports rather than imports funds. And I appreciate you bringing up that point. Representative Roland's on the list.
Yeah, thank you. I want to thank the superintendent for being here, and I understand this issue well. Though in some of our districts on the South Coast, and some of the eastern county districts, there isn't much of a gap. And therefore, it isn't available to them. And so hopefully, if our legislative council gets all the bills out, we'll have another bill that will be coming that will do another option for our local option that does something differently. And I'll share that with you because in your area it might work as well. So if this one doesn't, I'll share it with Representative Buckley as soon as it comes out. The superintendents in all of the South Coast schools, all declining enrollment schools, came up with this other idea and asked me to introduce it, and so we've been waiting for legislative council. So I'll get there because I think there really is an issue about having the ability at local areas to raise some money. Right now, my problem is the equity issue. Because of property valuations, some districts have this availability, some districts don't. I think that makes it difficult. I wish there was a local option for everybody that did something. We don't have that ability. And the other part that, and I think you've alluded to it and it was answered a little bit, was this ratcheting down of the property tax because of 47 and 50. We're in a lot different space than California that doesn't have that same issue. And I think a lot of our people in our state don't understand why is it so much harder for us than it is for other places who have property tax limitations. And
right.
It really
I think there's a lack of understanding, as I see it, based on our discussion that we've had here in our local community on our library issue and some other property tax issues that failed in November, was that people don't necessarily understand how their property tax bill works and the fact that it isn't, because they hear, you know, whatever it is, 10 cents per thousand, 30 cents per thousand, and they know that their next door neighbor sold their house for $400,000, and they think, well, that's what my house is worth, and they multiply it times that, as opposed to looking at their property tax bill and saying, you know, what is your assessed value? So I think there's a good education campaign that can take place that helps people to better understand how the taxation system does work in Oregon, because I find there's a lot of misunderstanding about it.
This is a request for the chair and possibly other committee members. I like to see the numbers. I like to see the data. When we use an example of 100 students are lost, that's a potential, what would be potentially $500,000 loss to a school district. But what is the actual amount lost in salaries? What's your average teacher salary? How much less are you having to pay for transportation? How much less are you having to pay for textbooks? And I can appreciate the situation in Ashland. As a school administrator, I have sat through more meetings than I can count to cut 5%, cut 10%, cut, come back 2 months later and cut another 5%. But the only way you can do that is to really see the numbers and how that's impacting students at different levels. So when we have these types of communications, I like to see the real hard numbers, not approximations. And it just helps me to, well, see it better and clearer.
We'll get you as much information as we can, Representative.
Well, because a lot of that stuff is readily available.
Perhaps, Committee, what we'll do is we'll make a list of any additional information that you need prior to bring this back up for another possible public hearing and work session. I do believe we have some assistance available to us to clarify. Superintendent, do you want to stay on the line to continue this discussion? Do you have time? Or?
I have about 5 more minutes, Representative Buckley.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. We are extremely grateful for your time and for the information you put forward. The former administrators on this committee are smiling and nodding their heads and offering you their appreciation. And, again, just thank you so much for bringing this bill forward, and thank you so much for spending time with us today.
And if there's any additional information that you need from us in terms of, you know, any more hard data or facts or that type of thing, just let me know, and we'll put that report together for you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Excellent job. Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, Brian Reeder from the Department of Education. I just wanted to try and shed some light on a few subjects here where I thought I heard misconceptions being expressed. The first one has to do with new property coming onto the tax rolls. New property in Oregon does not come on the tax rolls at its market value rate. So if I build a new house that has a market value of $300,000, my assessed value when I start paying taxes on that is not $300,000. What happens is my assessor goes out and looks at other properties in my community and says, well, assessed value is 20% lower than market value in the community, so he sets my assessed value at 20% below the $300,000. So in that sense, fast-growing communities don't have a smaller gap than other communities. In fact, fast-growing communities, to the extent that market values tend to go up much faster than the 3% increase in assessed values, tend to have a larger gap than slower-growing communities. So, and it is true that the level of the gap varies tremendously around the state. Some school districts have very large gaps that they can tap into with a local option. Other districts have relatively small gaps and have limited ability to tap into that additional revenue with local option taxes. And I did want to go back to Representative Wisnant's question about the 15%. There are two limits in the law right now on local option taxes. The first one is the one this bill is proposing to remove, and that is the $750 per weighted student. The other one is 15% of the district's revenue through the formula, which is the summation of their base grant plus their transportation grant, their high-cost disability grant, and their facility grant. Now, right now, in the 06-07 school year, if you express that on a per-weighted student basis, it's roughly $5,800. So you can compare the $750 per weighted student with, with 15% of $5,800, which is somebody.
It's about $800. $800.
So, Representative Boquist isn't here.
Okay, so it's about $800. So the cap, the local option cap, is the lower of those two amounts. You calculate them both, and the cap is the lower of them.
Okay. Was it with it?
Thank you. Thank you for that information, Brent. It's very helpful. When we put the 750 cap, what was the Department of Education's objective with the $750 cap?
Well, Chair Buckley, Representative Wisnant, I don't believe it was the department that passed that bill. That was not one of our bills. The objective, I believe, was to simply limit the amount that it was an equity concern. And the concern was, if you don't have caps on the amount that districts can raise through their local options, then those districts with a lot of room can raise a lot of additional revenue. Other districts cannot, and you may have an equity problem on your hands. That was the rationale behind that cap. Now, initially, as Representative Crummell said, initially the cap was $500 or 10%. And those were raised to $750 and 15% in the 03 session, I believe. And as has been expressed, the initial limit on how much a district can raise is really the room under the Measure 5 cap. So there really are three limits here. Measure 5 is the first one, and then you apply the other two. And as the over time, as market values grow faster than assessed values, that room under the Measure 5 cap gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And so the 500 and the 10% were adjusted upwards to recognize that they were becoming a limit, perhaps a limit that was too low on the amount that districts could raise through their local options.
Representative Rowland.
Thank you. So, in effect, if we took away those limits, and a person were to exercise the extent of the limit in their deal, what we would have is we'd have a $5 per thousand assessment on the real market value.
Chair Buckley, Representative Romo, yeah, I mean, a district could go out for a local option that brought most or all of their properties up to the Measure 5 limit of $5 per thousand of market value. Keep in mind that that limit is on individual properties, and we see differences in the amount of room under the cap
for each house
from property to property, from neighborhood to neighborhood, from city to city. And as I said, in areas that are growing very rapidly, where market values are growing rapidly, that room under the cap is getting bigger and bigger over time.
But from, you know, if you go back to equity of taxpayer, at the end of the day, if that was all used, everybody would be paying $5 per thousand of their market value of their home at that current assessment.
That's correct.
As opposed to the way it is now, which is different for each piece of property.
That's correct.
Excuse me.
Representative Kopp.
I just wanted to comment. I wanted to thank Chair Buckley for bringing this bill forward. The dialogue today has been incredible, especially as we look, you know, as our role to continue try to be equitable and serving all students throughout the state. This is obviously a real tough issue for declining enrolling schools, and there's a lot of them. So I appreciate the conversation, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions for Mr. Reeder?
I do have one question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Krell.
Mr. Reeder, do you know, either the school boards or the school administrators find it easier, do they prefer to be able to levy, when they're looking at the local option, being able to levy to the, say, for example, to the 750 cap instead of the percentage, precisely because of the issue that you brought up about the it can differ from property to property, and if they do it at 750, for example, then they're able to just to count on that amount of money as opposed, and it makes it easier for the assessor, quite frankly, to figure out what the cap or what the amount levied should be.
Yeah, Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, that remember that the 750 cap and the 15% cap are caps on the school district, and so they should, the district in circumstances where we can forecast well what their formula revenue is going to be, they should be able to know before they go out for their levy whether the 750 is lower or the 15% is lower. And so they'll know which of those caps is binding. Now, the difficulty in the tax system and with local options is because the room under the Measure 5 cap varies from property to property, it's hard to know how much a local option tax rate is going to raise. You can't base it on averages because every property is different. And so a tax rate of $2 per thousand on a property that has very little room will only raise that little bit, and it'll force that property into compression. On another property where there's a lot of room, it can raise the full $2. And so it's a very difficult thing for a district to really know how much a particular tax rate will raise. Now, one thing that I have done at the department is help school districts estimate how much that's going to be. And the way to do that is go get individual property level data from the county assessor and simulate it. And when you do it that way, you can get fairly close. But we've had examples of districts who, I think, didn't do that because they didn't fully understand the nature of the Measure 5 gap. They levied, say, a $2 per thousand expecting to raise $1 million, and at the end of the day they only collected half that much because of compression. So it's, you know, in some sense, we have a property tax system that creates a lot of uncertainty about how much money you can raise with a local option levy. And so one of the problems these caps create is if you raise more money than the cap, the excess flows back into the formula. And in essence, local taxpayers have raised money and they have just spread it out throughout the state. and no district and no taxpayer wants to do that, and they shouldn't do that.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Representative Roblin.
This is a question that Representative Greenlick asked about, and I'm not sure that you're the right person, because it's about the other side of Measure 5. The $10 is on the other side. There are some districts, some counties and cities that have not used the full amount that's available to them. But my understanding is that some of those can't raise that now because they had a chance but didn't take advantage of that. Is that true, or can they all raise to their statutory limits still?
Chair Buckley, Representative Roblin, non-schools have always had the ability to go out for local options.
Okay.
That was initially, in, I believe, part of Measure 5, and it's constitutional. It was only schools that were prohibited at the time, but the measure did leave the door open for schools to get that statutory ability to go for local options. So, yeah, cities and counties do have that ability to the extent that they're below the Measure 5 cap. And it's also, the two caps are separate. The school cap is $5, the non-school cap is $10, and you don't compete with counties for the room under the gap. Schools compete with community colleges and ESDs for the school gap, and non-schools compete among themselves for the non-school gap, but they don't compete with each other.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reeder, do you know at the Ashland School District, what's their ratio of property tax to state funds? Are they, I imagine their property tax is pretty high, so are they giving more than 30% of property tax for their?
Chair Buckley, Representative Wisner, I don't know that off the top of my head. There's 197 school districts in the state. I've chosen not to memorize the data for all of them.
Unbelievable.
So
I have four members. But wouldn't you assume that their property taxes, they're probably more than the 30%?
It would be pure speculation on my part. I really don't know.
You know, Chair?
I honestly don't. Thank you so much for coming forward. I greatly appreciate the clarification and your assistance, and I'm betting that we might be asking you to come back.
Okay. Thank you.
Was there anyone else who would care to offer testimony on House Bill 2641? Please come forward and identify yourself.
Okay. I wasn't planning on testifying. My name is Sam Gillespie, and I live in Clackamas County. I'm a 12-year board member of North Clackamas School District. A couple of quick comments. Most budgets, and you've probably heard this from superintendents across the district, our fixed cost every year is 93%. So we have a 7%, and this is operating budget, to operate under. And that doesn't give you a lot of room. We have put back textbooks and everything else, and we've tried to keep our staff at the highest level, so we are trying to keep our student-to-teacher ratio as low as we can with the money that we provide. We're happy that hopefully the governor's budget is going to be through. We actually think we need a little more than that, but I understand there's a lot of strains and a lot of demands on the budget. And the other thing that I'd like to say is that we're fortunate enough to pass the biggest levy for a high-growth district in the history of the state, $229.6 million. Now, we geared that down. We are in the process of purchasing property because we're running out of room on the east side of 82nd in North Clackamas County, where that's all where our growth is. And we need two elementary schools and a middle school, and we need another high school. Clackamas High School has just been online since 2000, and they are already at 2,400 students, and they are at the capacity of 2,000. So we are really busting at the seams. Now, this 229.6 is phase one. We really need $750 million to be able to put together in a high-growth district where to meet just the growth needs and the rehabilitation of our existing schools. We've been more fortunate than some of the other districts that we've been able to maintain a pretty good quality in our buildings, although some of them are really in need of some help, which this bond is going to address. So it's a very strong issue. I appreciate the fact of what you're talking about, the equalization problem that's always been there, but I still think if there's some way in any legislation where you can allow something that I think that the superintendent was testifying to, she alluded to, is that you might have to try and keep it as flexible as you can so that certain districts can They have different needs. I think Representative Greenleck said in the three districts where he has people, in Hillsborough, Portland, certainly all, and what was the other one, Beaverton, all three of those districts have different needs. Beaverton is like North Clackamas, a high-growth district. Their voters have been very generous in operation level. We got killed 2 years ago when we went for an operating levy just to try and, to purchase textbooks and smithics. We got clobbered. And we were very worried about our capital improvement bond. And like I said, that's phase one. We need two more. So it's a difficult problem, so I appreciate your legislation.
Elizabeth, thank you so much. Any questions, gentlemen? Thank you so much for serving on your school board and for being a passionate advocate for education.
Thank you.
Any other folks willing to testify on House Bill 2641? Seeing none, I'm going to close this public hearing on House Bill 2641. Committee, thank you very much for that discussion. I greatly appreciate it. I'm going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2217, our second public hearing on this bill. I'd like to call forward Ms. James Sager from the Governor's Office and Chris Alanek from Legislative Revenue. And if Mr. Olson will remind us what the bill is all about, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2217 increases the corporate minimum tax that applies to C corporations for Oregon sales, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2007, establishes the corporate minimum tax fund for net revenues, dedicates monies in the fund to Head Start programs, Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, and workforce development programs, takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment. You have before you the staff measure summary and draft revenue impact statement. The staff measure summary is updated since our last hearing on this. The revenue impact statement is the same as the one you saw previously. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Gentlemen, thank you. Welcome. If you had additional testimony you'd like to offer, or are you just making yourself available for questions, how does it seem to you right now?
Chair Buckley, I'm just here to answer questions.
Very good. Members of the committee, there were several questions on this bill previously. We had a somewhat detailed discussion, but it seemed that more information was needed. Are there any questions of these witnesses at this point on this bill? Give you a second to stare at
what the questions were. Mr. Chair? And didn't we get a document, maybe, that answered a bunch of them?
We did get an email I think Mr. Olson has copies of. Before, if we do have any questions for you, if you'd identify yourselves before you answer. It looks so far, we're still trying to figure out if there are any. Representative Clem.
I might. One of the questions, somebody had some math skills up here. Notice there was $12 million more, and the question was answered that the difference between the, essentially the $12 million apparently is the increase in the revenue estimate since the time they made the budget. Is that correct?
Who goes for that?
For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chris Alanek, Legislative Revenue Office. Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct. It's simply an update. I believe the number that was in the governor's budget was from based on 03 data and forecasted at sometime last fall. And the figures that I put together for the draft revenue impact statement have incorporated more recent information. Mm-hmm. So it's essentially an updated forecast.
So follow up on that, Chair.
Follow up.
So the programs that we were talking about funding, fully funding Head Start, implementing shared responsibility model fully, and a certain amount to skill up fund. So I guess my question is, should we be looking at how to maybe peel back somewhere to save the $12 million because it's not needed for those three programs?
Chair Buckley, for the record, James Sager from the Governor's Office. Representative Clem, we developed the governor's budget using $84 million divvied up between those three programs that you mentioned. So as the process goes through the Revenue Committee and Ways and Means, it wouldn't be inappropriate that the legislature, if they discovered that there were additional revenues there, that they would allocate those revenues someplace else. We calculate that we need $84 million to fully implement the three programs that we have identified.
follow?
Well, I guess I had a question. Is there a lot of other folks to testify as well?
I believe we have just one person signed up, one additional person signed up, but there might be other folks in the audience.
And we're in public hearing, but not necessarily work
session.
That's
correct, Representative. Okay. We're in public hearing.
I think I had some more discussion points, but not questions, really.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Roblin.
Yeah, my question is, and we're here as a policy committee, and you know we listen to the different policy parts, and I, for one, on this committee, don't see. I might want more money in that fund to use for other things, and I see that as the revenue part of this bill, and I would like revenue to figure out what they want to do, and I want to make sure that you know when we're having the discussions here, we're really talking about the policies behind these programs, which I think are essential. I mean, these are programs that I think we have to have, and if for whatever reason revenue didn't like this fund, I don't care. They better fund these programs. So this is just one opportunity to do that, and they may need to go to the general fund. I don't care where they go, but from policy, my perspective on this committee is that I'm looking at Head Start fully funded. I'm looking at opportunity grants and the workforce as essential programs. And I think the testimony that came the last time was clear from my perspective that those are important programs that the state of Oregon needs at those levels. And so, in response to that, I guess what I'm asking you is you're not set on those numbers that are here. That's not the big issue. Well, the governor's budget is set on these numbers that are right here. But as a legislative body, our revenue department group and Ways and Means need to decide how they want to use that, if that's the way they want to do it or whatever.
Chair Buckley, Representative Roblin, yes, the governor's budget was built on these dollars for these programs, but again, this is a legislative process, and we're here to work with you.
It's good to have you.
And I appreciate the testimony.
Any other questions for these witnesses? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sager, the $35 million for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, we funded that at $47 million last year, I believe.
Chair Buckley, Representative Wisnett, we actually were up, total for the biennial, we were up around $78 million. But part of that came out of lottery money. So anyway, when we put the money in place, the governor's proposal is at $110 million, and so it would require $35 million additional general fund revenue to get to that level. So that's why the $35 million is identified.
So, well, can I clarify?
Yes.
So the numbers was in the governor's budget for opportunity grants is 100?
It's about 110, 111 million.
110. Okay, and this is a plus. And can follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow?
Mr. Sager, so the $35 million, is that strictly for the shared responsibility, gearing that up, and how long is it going to take to gear that up? And
Chair Buckley, Representative Wisnett, yes, that is strictly for the shared responsibility model. We had originally planned to ramp that up over 3 years, beginning with the second year of the 07-09 biennium, because Student Assistance Commission is already issuing statements for this next fall, so we're always a year behind as far as students going to school. So the program is to ramp up next spring for the 08-09 school year. That money would begin that full ramping up so that by the end of the 09-11 biennium, for sure, our projection is that there would be enough money there to meet all the demand. And we're hoping that actually we begin to change demand. That is, we want to drive more students into the schools because the financial barrier has been removed for them.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
I
agree with Representative Roblin. This is a policy committee, but I get a little Ways and Means here, and I just have to.
I understand.
I have to go after it.
So noted. Representative Dahl.
No, so
I'm sorry. You're still following me? I thought you were just commenting there, Representative Roblin.
What's going on with this Ways and Means now?
Excuse me, Representative Dahl. Continue.
Okay, so explain to me, Mr. Sager, because I'm supportive of the shared responsibility model. All right. So how are we going to continue to fund this if we're not going to be fully offering everyone a four-year degree next biennium? So how are we going to continue to fund that?
Chair Buckley, Representative Wisnett, thank you for that question because it opens up a conversation we haven't had yet. The governor's education funding plan puts in place a a strategy to not only fully fund the shared responsibility model going into the future, but in fact move the entire education enterprise to an adequate and stable level of funding. So within the budget for this first biennium, we've included $35 million that, as I indicated, will make the first very significant, if not 100% of the way, but significant step on the shared responsibility model. In the 09-11 biennium, then, we have applied the governor's plan to the projected revenue to show that we can, in fact, sustain that effort and meet what is the projected need.
And a follow-up comment. Thank you for your answers. I apologize I didn't get you my written responses, but thank you for being responsive.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dahlin.
It's one of the issues that I know that we're dealing with, and I feel like I'm not part of the discussion, particularly when it comes to C Corps. I know that the governor's office, the Senate, and the House are all looking at a rainy day fund and how they will get at C Corps on the rainy day fund. To me, this is an intricate piece of that puzzle, and I'm wondering how I can make that decision. I've already made the decision in the interim that we must fully fund Head Start. I've already made the decision in the interim that I fully support the other two programs. It is my job to bring that grizzly into camp. It is their job to skin it, and I don't have all the pieces here, so I'm really reluctant to say to these people to do something with C Corp when they got about three or four other balls in the air.
I'd be happy to respond that once we send it down to revenue, they will change it any way they care to change it. we are as a policy committee giving our opinion of this approach, and they will take that I'm sure in with great respect, and then do with it whatever they want to. But so I think the question arises for us again whether this is a policy to set up the corporate minimum tax fund and target the corporate funds from that source to these programs is good policy for the state of Oregon. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just out of curiosity, we've got Section 5, so that makes this act take effect the 96th day after the date after we sign and die, adjourn, sign and die. Why not start it with the new tax year, like on January 1, 2008, or on July 1 at the new biennium? What was it? Why was it that this would take effect on the 91st day?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, the bill takes effect the 91st day, but in Section 2 it identifies the tax years to which it applies, and so it does apply to tax years beginning on January 1, 2007.
Okay.
I think that gets at your question.
That does. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, I guess the question that I have is that if fully funding, and it's not necessarily a question, although maybe Mr. Sager might want to attempt to answer this, but if it's important that we fully fund Head Start, defined in here as a pre-kindergarten programs, and if it's really important that we fully fund the Oregon Opportunity Grant, including the shared responsibility model, and if it's really important that we pay for the workforce development programs, then why isn't it really important that we take it out of expected existing revenues? We're expecting to have a 17.3, give or take a little bit, percent increase in revenues, and I see these tied to a new or another revenue source, and I would argue that if it's a function of government that should be done, then it should come out of anticipated existing revenues, as opposed to raising another fee or another fund to do that. Can you help me out?
Sager would like to respond.
Yes, Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell. A couple things to point out. At the time that the governor releases his budget, December 1st, it must be balanced. And so we always have to identify if programs exceed the current revenue, then he has to identify what the new revenue source is to make sure that everything is balanced. So in essence, if this takes effect, it becomes general fund revenue, and we're saying that this part of the general fund revenue should go to these programs. The second part of that is the reason that we focused on the corporate minimum, quite honestly, is talking with leaders in the business community. They have made it clear to the governor repeatedly that they feel very strongly about fully funding Head Start. They feel very strongly about opening up post-secondary education to all Oregonians. And while we're talking there at the front end and kind of the intermediate step, people going to post-secondary, they also need their current workforce to be trained. So they're beneficiaries of this. So they saw the connection between having the corporate minimum that hasn't been raised since 1931 increase to actually benefit the very programs that they see benefit Oregon's economy and therefore Oregon's businesses. And so there was a good relationship there, and we had a lot of, again, good support and good conversation with the corporate community.
Follow up, Mr. Chair? Let me just do a cut-off here. We will have opportunity to discuss the philosophy behind this in our work session when we have it, so just to note that.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that. In a follow-up, though, won't this eventually be lost? Won't the revenues that are going to come in from raising the corporate minimum basically be lost, though, to the general fund? And future legislatures are going to say, oh, yeah, you know, that's important, but, gee, you know what? We just don't have enough money to because we no longer can sequester what is the difference in the corporate minimum. So, yeah, it's important to fund Head Start, but, you know, gee, we just don't have enough in existing revenue, so we need to raise something else. Can you quick response?
Yes, Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, very quickly, that's always possible. The legislature can always say notwithstanding some other section, but in fact, the governor feels very strongly that we need to begin that course now, and hopefully we can maintain it.
Thank you. Representative Blitzen, and we do have one other witness that wants to testify, and we have about 8 or 10 minutes left.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to ask Mr. Sager to be sure the governor knows I personally support these programs, but I hope he's got money set aside if three-fifths of this body does not support funding it this way, or it goes to the voters and the voters do not refer it or approve the suspension or overthrowing the kicker. I guess this one doesn't have to go to the voters. This is going to. So I hope because I'd like to see these programs funded, and I hope that the governor has money set aside if the House does not provide the three-fifths.
I do. Chair Buckley, as I mentioned a moment ago, we are here to work with you, and hopefully we can find resolution.
Diplomatically stated.
Just a quick comment, Representative Wisnett. In the 80s, when I was on the school board, we called that a safety net. And we don't want to be there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim, very much. I appreciate it. Don Schellenberg, you've been very patient. Thank you, sir, for hanging in with us.
Thank you, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. I'm Don Schellenberg, representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Here in opposition to 2217 as it relates to the fee structure for farm and ranch operations. Now, I wondered when I was looking at this bill, you know, why is this in the Education Committee? It didn't make sense to me at first, but after having heard this discussion, it makes complete sense why this bill is here. Now I understand. My comments do not relate to the use of the funds. We appreciate the provision which applies to S corporations, of which there are a number in the agricultural community. Our concern, however, is for what used to be considered the larger farms, but which are now near the average for those who earn their entire livelihood from agricultural production. It is not unusual for them to gross in the $500,000 to $1 million range just to earn enough to meet family and business capital expenses. According to the bill, the new fee would cost them an extra $1,500 a year just for the privilege of doing business in this state. I apologize for having to repeat myself year after year, but the legislation does not recognize agriculture generally as different than nearly any other business, and therefore usual solutions don't work when applied to agriculture. The difference I refer to is that we have no way of passing on our increased costs, whether that be increased fuel cost, increased fertilizer cost, increased feed cost, increased equipment cost, automatic increasing wage costs, or government fees. The market sets the price for our perishable commodity, and we're forced to sell in a timely manner. On my own farm, I just got a contract in the mail yesterday for Austrian field peas. It simply states the price per pound I will be paid. Do I have an opportunity to negotiate this price? No. It's take it or leave it. Since I don't have a better option, I will take it and hope the weather cooperates better than 2 years ago when I did this same thing and just barely broke even. The point here, of course, is that the fee structure would make sense for agriculture only if it is calculated based on the net receipts of the business, not the gross receipts. Then the fee for the same business would be a reasonable in the $100 range if you applied a net income to the fee structure that's in place in the bill here now. I would suggest two options for change to meet agriculture concerns: either recalculate the fee structure based on net income or create a separate fee structure that would reflect the realities faced by production agriculture. Thank you for your time today and appreciate your discussions today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, any questions? Representative Dolan.
Yes, Don. Could you give me some notion of what the margin is on a family farm to investment, both operating and maintenance and the land, to return? And then there's going to be a second part of this question, Don. What's happening to our family farms? Are we getting more of them, less of them, and does this have anything to do with that?
Chair Buckley, Representative Dolan, I don't know that I can answer your first question. that's probably all over the board.
Sure.
As far as what the return is on the investment. The second question, what's happening to the family farm? The family farms, those who are making their entire living on the farm, are getting larger and larger. And again, we're back to the same concern that I raised. We don't have the ability to pass on those increased costs. So you're in the cost-price squeeze. The only way you get out of that cost-price squeeze, you're making a little bit of money. You can make more money if you do more work. And so the farms are getting bigger in order to have more volume, in order to make the same amount of money they were making the year before, so they can continue on. So family farms in that regard are getting larger. Now, there's also an increasing number of small farms, hobby farms, if you will, like mine. I mean, I've got a 90-acre hobby farm. couldn't support me, couldn't begin to support me on that. And my wife keeps making sure I keep my day job. So there are more and more of the hobby farms coming in, and fewer of the farms that support an entire family operation.
Go ahead. Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we could certainly talk about that topic. I could talk to you about it all day. The margin is somewhere far below zero that you can't count probably, in any normal business environment, because you wouldn't be there. My question, I guess, I'm either missing something or some emails I've seen and the point you raised about net income. Every single person paying the minimum income tax, don't they already have a net income of zero? That's why they're paying the minimum, because they don't have any other taxes.
Chair Buckley, Representative Clem, now maybe we're talking about two different things here.
Yeah.
I'm talking about minimum corporate tax.
Right.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding what this is. My understanding was this is a corporation fee that you pay on a yearly basis. Simply for the fact that you are a corporation.
Yes.
So doesn't have anything to do with where I think you're going.
Right, yeah. I think, follow Mr. Chair, I guess I always just listen to the word corporate minimum tax, and I assumed if you paid taxes because you made money, so you paid your 6.6%, you made 100 grand, let's say, so you paid your, whatever that is, $6,600, that you wouldn't pay the corporate minimum. It's only if you made no money that you then, in lieu of that, pay the corporate minimum. So at least you chip something into the kitty. Is that not the way this works?
Chair Buckley, representing the claimant, I think I understand what you're saying, and you may be right on that count. I'm not exactly sure, but if you are making zero, where would I have the $1,500 to pay the minimum tax?
Yeah, if I might follow up, that's exactly the point. I mean, I think what happens is I think I got it right. I think if you pay something. If you pay more than, like under the current law, if you pay more than $10 because you made money, well, then you're good. If you didn't, and you say you lost money, or you did lose money, or whatever your accountant tells you, you know, it works out to be, you still got to pay $10. And so the policy question is there still some amount higher than 10 that is reasonable just because you are here and, you know, your business is using the education system to train its workers, so should you chip in a little something, and is 10 the right amount? I know it was set in like 1913 or something like that. But I've seen my Chamber of Commerce, too, talking about net income, and I think this only applies to people who had zero net income. So you can't switch to that because that's we're only talking about people. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Thank you for saying we are talking about a minimum tax. I mean, you're quite correct as far as my understanding. It's a minimum tax. And I do think you have the right frame on it, that this is a question of what is fair for a minimum. You know, if you do not make money, what do you still chip in because you are making use of the resources of the community?
Right. And I had one more if I could.
Yes.
And this applied to the fellow that was here the other day, the gasoline dealers, gasoline stations in my district. I really am looking at, and I know I'm not in the revenue committee, and I'll probably go over there and chime in there as well, but... You know, I'm looking at this, and I know in our orchard we grossed, you know, probably $250,000 worth of pears that went through our place. Mm-hmm. We lost $38,000 last year. We lost 20-something the year before. We made 11 one time. We lost the three before that. Yeah. You know, and so, again, where does the money come from? Well, it comes out of the reserves, or comes the fact we went and got, my family went and all got other jobs, you know, so we can keep the place alive. And I'm not disputing that there might be something raised, but I'm not so sure there isn't a way to say something like, if there's a small number of employees, which most farms or a gasoline dealer, they're not going to have a lot of employees, maybe, you know, they ought to be moved down a little bit, because they may gross a ton and not make anything because the margins are so horrible because they're competing with other countries mostly. But I think then you got to go bigger on the people who have... You know, they got 5,000 employees in the state, and their accountant figured out how to have them make no money. Well, they left a footprint, and I think maybe you go higher.
I think these are all legitimate...
It's not a question, is it? Sorry.
These are legitimate points to make on trying to determine what is a fair corporate minimum tax. The governor has a proposal here. I believe each one of our caucuses has a proposal. You know what might be fair as well. So we'll give it to Scott. Well, thank you so much for being here today. Appreciate you coming forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have maybe two more minutes. If there's someone else who didn't sign up who wants to come forward, and we will have at least one other public hearing / work session on this bill before we move. Thank you, members of the committee. I'm going to close.
Mr. Chair, before you close, maybe
yes,
something that we could have clarified for us by the by legislative revenue.
Yes, sir.
And that is this bill applies a $10 fee to S corporations and then all other corporations, but it is based on sales.
Yeah.
Yes.
So in Representative Clem's example, if they have $250,000 plus in sales,
correct.
Even though they lost $38,000, they would still have to pay $1,000.
Yes. That is correct.
We're going to have to sell more.
If you'd like a representative here from Revenue,
I think that would be good to clarify this for us, and also to clarify whether or not this is in lieu of state income tax or in addition to state income tax.
This okay, we'll get that question for you. My understanding is this is in addition. Thank you.
Can we end Go Beavers or what?
We end with Go Beavers. On that note, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2217 and close this session of the House Education Committee. Thank you very much, members.